we resume our conversation from last week with Quincy Troop, author of the critically acclaimed book Miles, the Autobiography. Miles Davis began playing the trumpet at the age of 12 or 13 years old. 2 years later, he was playing professionally. It was at this time that music began to dominate his life. Here's Quincy Troop.
At one time, he wanted to be a baseball player. And then when he started to play the trumpet, after he got this trumpet, and he started listening to his music, and he started to play the trumpet, it just started to dominate his life. He just, from then on, that's all he wanted to do was play music. As he said in Miles' autobiography, music was a curse for him. It was just a curse for him. He had to play. He had to do it, you know. So, but it was around 12 or 13 years old.
Davis began playing with the Eddie Randall Band in 1943. In the book, Davis said it exposed him to writing and arranging music. This really helped to shape young Miles Davis's musical career.
Eddie Randall had the best band in the Midwest. He had one of the best bands in the Midwest. Everybody says so. There are no recordings of his band, and I knew him quite well. He died also. He was about 95 when he died. He was an undertaker, so he owned a funeral home, which was a very successful funeral home, but he played music on his spare time. And so there are no recordings of, but everybody I talked to said that he had the best band, one of the best bands in the Midwest. And so Miles played in that band, played first trumpet in that band. And then Eddie Randall also allowed Miles, after a while, after he saw he was really good and could write and could handle a band, to arrange for these great musicians and to kind of conduct the band. You know what I mean? He let him do that. And so Miles grew a lot from just that experience of being able to arrange and write music and for this band, you know? So that was an invaluable experience for a young man who was like maybe, 16, 17 years old, you know? So, you know, that was an invaluable experience because he was still in high school. So, and Miles used to play a lot with this band. He played a lot with this band. And so, in around the St. Louis area. So he got a lot of experience playing with them, and it taught him a lot about being a band leader, also by watching Eddie Randall, and also by his ability to be able to handle the musicians and arrange and do all the other stuff.
Miles Davis was a supremely confident musician, often viewed as arrogant by critics and others from a distance. But Troop explained that Davis did lose confidence in the presence of his idol, Charlie Parker.
The only time he felt that he could not do it was when he went to New York and started playing with Charlie Parker. Every night he was playing with Charlie Parker's band. And he told me that he, up until that point, he knew that he could really play with anybody. He felt he could play with anybody. Miles, a lot of people thought that Miles Davis was arrogant. It wasn't that he was arrogant. He was supremely confident. And a supremely confident person sometimes can appear arrogant because of the fact they believe that they can do whatever they are doing. So Miles had supreme confidence in his ability to play anything. But he told me that when he played with Charlie Parker, when he first started playing with Charlie Parker, he said he used to want to quit every night because Charlie Parker, the tempo of the music that he was playing was so high, he just didn't think that he could cut it. But he was able to cut it. You know, he was able to cut it. But that was the only time that I think that Miles had a lack of confidence.
Despite opposition from his mother, in September 1944, Miles Davis moved to New York to be near his idol, Charlie Parker.
One thing, his mother, who wanted him to go to Fisk, wanted him to go to Fisk University, where he could play in that choir. They had a big argument about that. And I think he got very, I mean, I think it hurt their relationship for the rest of their life, for the rest of the time that they were, both of them were alive, or his mother was alive, because she was insisting that he go to Fisk. He wanted to go to Juilliard, and his father was going to let him go to Juilliard. And the reason he wanted to go to Juilliard was not so much he thought he could learn a lot from Juilliard. He thought he could learn something from there. He did think he could learn something from there. But he also wanted to go to New York just so he could be around Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Art Blakey and Sarah Vaughan and Billy Eckstein and those great musicians. He wanted to go there specifically, though, to be around Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. He felt he could learn a lot from them, and he felt that if he got there and he got a chance to play with them, then he could learn a lot from them. So that's why he really wanted to go to New York.
When Miles eventually found Charlie Parker in New York, the two made live appearances and played on recordings between 1945 and 1948. One of those recordings was Grooving High. That musical excerpt was from Charlie Parker and Miles Davis. It was entitled Groovin' High. The relationship between Miles and Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Art Blakey, Sarah Vaughan, was that of mentor and student.
He found Dizzy Gillespie quite easily, but Charlie Parker, who was a big junkie, big dope deal, he couldn't find him. He found Dizzy, and Dizzy introduced him to Monk and a lot of other people. So he immediately was because he had played, you remember, he had played in Billy Eckstein's band when it came to the Riviera in St. Louis before he went to New York. When Miles was 17, he was a senior in high school. He had played with that band when it came to New York, to St. Louis, because Buddy Anderson, the great trumpet player, was sick, and Dizzy, being over the trumpet section, needed a trumpet player, and Miles came into the Riviera Club in St. Louis with a trumpet, and he just asked, and Dizzy asked him, could he read music, could he play, and could he read music, and he said, yeah. And when they found out he could play, then they let him be in the band. So he was in that band for the length of time that band stayed in St. Louis. So he met Charlie Parker, he met Dizzy Gillespie, he met Sarah Vaughan, he met Billy Eckstein, he met Charlie Parker. He met all these people in the band. And so when he went to New York, he knew a lot of these people, but he knew a lot of great musicians anyway, because they were coming up and down from the Mississippi, up and down the Mississippi River, like Freddie Webster, he had met him, and they were coming from Kansas City. So he had met a lot of musicians by this time. So when he got to New York, he went looking for Charlie Parker, but he couldn't find him at first, but he did find Dizzy. By the time he kept looking around for Charlie Parker, by this time he was starting to play at Minton's and some other clubs. And one night, Frats Navarro, all these great musicians, and one night he was looking for Charlie Parker, and Charlie Parker came up behind him and said, yeah, I heard you've been looking for me. So that was when he met again with Charlie Parker in New York. And I think Bird moved in with him, if my recollection is correct. He kind of moved in with him and became like his mentor while he was going to Juilliard until Irene came, who had two children by Miles, came to live with him, and then he moved out. But his relationship was great. I mean, the musicians respected and loved Miles Davis's ability. That's what musicians deal with. They deal with, can you play or not? Can you play or not? And if you can play, then you can be with them. You can hang.
In his book, Miles and Me, Troop said that as a kid growing up in St. Louis, that Miles Davis's music and pride saved him. Troop elaborated further.
Well, I was going to a school. I had integrated a school in St. Louis and where they didn't want me there. The white kids didn't want me to be there. So I felt very uncomfortable being in a school, one of seven black people being in a school of 3,000 white kids, especially since they didn't want me there. And we were having fights all the time because they were trying to run me out of the school, and I wasn't going to take no whoopings and things like that. So the music that they liked, Pat Boone singing those songs that he sang, I just didn't like that music. And so that was the situation that I was in. I was a sophomore in high school. And one day I went in and heard that music of Miles Davis. And I desperately wanted to be hip at that time. I desperately wanted to be someone who had his finger on the pulse of stuff. And I wanted to hear and understand what the great music of the day was. And when I heard Miles's music, it just turned me around. So that's how it saved my life, because all of a sudden I had this music to listen to. I had this person who didn't take any stuff off anybody to emulate in a lot of ways. I learned how to dress from Miles Davis. I can throw fashion together pretty well too. And so, you know, he kind of saved my life in that way. You know, taught me about the music. I didn't know him, but just from listening to his music, and he taught me about how an African American man could be you can be proud. You didn't have to be groveling to somebody. You didn't have to be groveling to anybody who was a white man or whatever. And then at the same time, he taught me fashion, you know. So he taught me an attitude, fashion, and he taught me a great appreciation of great music. And so for me, in the situation that I was in St. Louis, that's what I meant when I said it saved my life.
September 28, 1991 was the day Miles Davis died. During his hospitalization, Troop, a close friend of Davis, did not visit his friend in the hospital. He explained his reasons this way.
I was right in residence at the Loft in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I had just talked to Miles a week before, and we were going to get together and write a play. I was going to write the play, he was going to write the music, and he was going to give me two paintings. So when I came back from Minneapolis, I was going to go up to his house the next week, the next Wednesday, which was going to be the next Wednesday. And go up and see him and start to work on this play and all, whatever. I think it was the next Wednesday or one of those days. And anyway, when I got to the airport, my wife called me and said, my wife picked me up at the airport. My wife Margaret, Margaret Porter Troop, who has an art gallery here in San Diego called the Porter Troop Gallery. She picked me up at the airport and said Miles's sister had called and said that Miles had this severe stroke and that he was, he was unconscious and paralyzed and all of this, and I should call her right away. So when I got back home, I got back to my house, and I called her on the phone, and she said, ask me, was I going to come up to see him, because she had to put my name on the list, because I was like part of the family, so she was going to put my name on the list, but everybody's name had to be on the list. And I said, okay, let me call you back. And so she said, okay. I thought about it for a minute, and I asked her how did he look? And she explained to me that he was unconscious, in a coma, paralyzed, and all these tubes. And I decided I didn't want to see Miles Davis like that. I really didn't want to see him like that. I didn't want to see him with all those tubes up his nose. They didn't think he was going to survive. And I didn't want to see him like that. I wanted to remember the last conversation I had with him, which was a great conversation, funny, everything else. I wanted to remember the last time I saw him, which was a great, you know, time we had together. And I wanted to remember him like that. So when I called Dorothy back, I told her I didn't think I was going to come because of the fact that I didn't want to see him like that. And maybe it has something to do with Miles Davis too, also saying that he didn't like to go to funerals. I don't like funerals, but that I have gone to some funerals myself, but I didn't want to see him in that state. I really didn't want to see him like that. As for the funeral in New York, they had asked me to be a part of the people, one of the persons who spoke at his funeral. I decided that I didn't want to go to that too, because I thought it was going to be a circus, and I just didn't want to go. I mean, and I found out that it was later on that it was all these people were arguing about it. They wanted to be on, and how come so and so was speaking and they weren't speaking. I didn't want to be a part of that, because I mean, I really loved the man, and I just wanted to celebrate his life in my own private way with my family, and I just wanted to remember him like he was, and like the relationship that we had. I didn't want to be a part of that. So that's why I didn't go up to see him in the hospital. And that's why I didn't go to the funeral.
Before he died, Troop recalled a conversation he had with Miles Davis about James Baldwin, a good friend of Davis.
I was with Miles. We were in New York, and I told him, you know, that that Jimmy Baldwin had died, because I had been to France to interview James Baldwin. I did the last interview with James Baldwin, by the way. And Miles had been one of the reasons why I went over there, because Miles told me that James Baldwin was one of his best friends, and that was the only place that he went and stayed in France. When he was in Europe, he would take 5 days out of his tour, and he would go and spend that time with James Baldwin. And they were old friends. And so they were really, really, really close friends. And Miles was the one saying I should go and interview Jimmy Baldwin for this book. So I did. And I went as a part of my whole trip to Paris and France and other places in Europe to collect information for this book. Jimmy Baldwin was somebody I went to see. Anyway, while I was there, I found out that he was really on his deathbed. I didn't know he was on his deathbed. And when I arrived, I was going to do this interview with him about Miles Davis and his brother David, who also has died since of the same ailment of stomach cancer. David picked me up at the airport and said to me, "Listen, Quincy," I knew David from New York, where he was a bartender down at McHale's, where everybody used to play and where Miles used to hang out, where I used to go. And so I knew David, knew him very well. He said, "Listen, don't interview Jimmy Ball and Jimmy just about Miles Davis. This is probably going to be the last interview that he's going to do. So ask him about everything that you can think of." So I did. And so that's the background to this whole thing. So when I interviewed him and I came back to the United States, and I didn't see Miles for a minute, but then I went down to see him, and I told him that he was ill. I told him that Jimmy was ill. He said, "Oh, really?" He was shocked. He said, "Yeah." He said, "I knew he was kind of didn't feel well the last time I saw him, but he was on his deathbed." I said, I think so." And I was there when the doctor came and said that he was probably going to live no more than a month. And I didn't want to say that to Miles, but you know, I thought he was told him that he was very ill. And so about a week or so later, 10 days later, I was going down to talk to Miles again to interview him. And in the meantime, they had told me that Jimmy Baldwin had died. And when I got there, I told Miles that Jimmy Baldwin had died, James Baldwin had died the night before or whatever. And he seemed kind of shocked. And Miles got up and went into the bathroom and stayed a long time in the bathroom. And when he came out, his eyes were red. His eyes were red and he was kind of sniffling. And he was kind of really quiet. So I knew that he had been in the bathroom crying about Jimmy. But Miles was the kind of guy, didn't want nobody to see him cry like that. He just didn't want you to see him. So he went in the bathroom and he wept.
Somehow, though, even as Miles grieved of his friend's death, you get the impression that Miles felt he would see Baldwin again. As Troop put it, Miles believed in life after death.
Yeah, Miles really believes in that. He believes that I'd go over his house, and I thought it was rather strange. I'd go over his house, and I write about all this in Miles and Me. I'd go over his house sometime, and I'd walk in, and I'd sit down, and he'd say, "Yeah, I just had a conversation with my father." And then he'd say, "Yeah," and I was talking to Train and Bird and Thelonious Monk or Gil Evans, and they were talking about this. And you know, but I'd grown accustomed to it towards the end. But when he first told me that, I walked in one day and he told me he'd had a conversation with somebody, Monk or somebody, I was stunned. I was really stunned. Or I had a conversation with John Coltrane. And he said it in a sincere, I mean, he believed this. He really believed it. And it was one of the things he said in the book, Miles, the autobiography, that the music is up there someplace because we blew it up there. So I think that Miles believes, and probably if you believe what Miles believes, that he's around, he's playing somewhere, that he's playing someplace, because he thought spiritually, your spirit lived eternally. So, yeah, I would give him that.
Considered one of the all-time great melodic soloists of our generation, Miles Davis can be characterized as having unusual and very skillful timing with simple or complex melodic phrases. His influence on music, in particular jazz, is a lasting legacy.
His constant and continuing legacy is the fact that he played great music, that he was a risk taker, that he was a fabulous musician, probably one of the greatest artists of the 20th century, along with Picasso, Pablo Picasso. I would rank them both up there like that, Pablo Picasso and Miles Davis, because they both were risk takers, and they both kept changing up their approach to art, and with great results. Both of them with great results. I would think that being a risk taker, being someone who is always trying to experiment and trying to stay current with the times, I would think that that was a part of his legacy. But also the fact that he played such great music, he played such beautiful music, such strong music that will endure. This music is going to endure. It's going to be around for a long time. And I think that in his lifetime, he was probably, I thought, he was the most influential musician that was living. I witnessed Miles Davis around Madonna, around Bono from U2, around Sting, around Santana, around the great musicians of our time. I mean, most popular. And I watched how they gave deference to him, how they gave it up to him, that he was the master. You could see that they felt that he was the master. They all did. All of them did. Mick Jagger, you could just talk about any famous person you want to talk about, and they all gave deference to Miles Davis. It was amazing to see. And I could see it because I was up close with him, So I think that his the example that he left, that he was so committed to the music. He was committed to it. He was disciplined. He was focused. He always wanted to have a great band. He always wanted to have a great band that was capable of playing the greatest music that they could play at the time. So I think that all of that comes into the legacy of Miles Davis.
Every artist has critics, and Miles Davis was no exception. Troop, though, believed that Miles Davis proved his critics wrong.
I've talked to some people. I really have talked to a lot of people. I don't want to name their names, but there are a lot of people have said to me that they were wrong. A lot of prominent critics have said to me that they were wrong. The point is this. Most people like to use the phrase that, people being ahead of their time. I don't think anybody is ahead of their time. I think that people are on time. I think they're on the time. They're in the time that is now. They're on time. But the rest of the people are behind time. Most people are behind time. 90 to 95% of the people have not caught up with anything. They're always behind. They're behind in race relations. They're behind in fashion. They're behind in music. They're behind in art and everything. They're just 95% behind. Most 95% of the people are behind what is current and what is happening. I mean, the same thing has happened with rap. When rap first came out, everybody just thought it was going to be a short thing. It's not short. It's all over the world. I knew it was going to be all over the world. It's all over the world. They just were wrong, And it's just like Paul Simon said on his great album, Graceland. He said, every generation runs a new hero up the pop charts, which means that every generation is going to have their own music. And Miles knew that. See, Miles knew that every generation was going to have their own music. What I like is different from my mother. What my son likes is different from me. What my youngest son likes is different from what my oldest son likes. But I am able now to listen to all of it because of the fact that I have a 34-year-old son and I have a 17-year-old son. So I can listen to all of it. I've been in the house with all of them. So Miles knew that. So I would say that, a lot of people, they just have missed the boat. They missed the boat like they always do, like they missed the boat with Mozart and Beethoven, and they missed the boat with rap, like they missed the boat with Thelonious Monk, like they missed the boat with John Coltrane. They missed the boat. They just miss. they just miss because they're behind and they're not current, whether it's Picasso's paintings or what have you. They're just not up on it.
Quincy wrote of Miles Davis, he was a singular spirit, one who marched only to the tempo of his own St. Louis bugle and the rhythms and techniques of his own heart. Troop said that he will miss his friend, Miles Davis.
Oh, I miss him terribly. I really miss Miles Davis. I mean, not only me, a lot of people miss Miles Davis. A lot of people, I was just up at Monterey. I went up to the Monterey Jazz Festival. Played records, played and showed slides. It was about 1,000 people there. It was wonderful. And people would come up to me and say, all these people, musicians, everybody said, hey, Quincy, they would come up to me because they knew I wrote Miles' book, these two books. They said, man, don't you, I miss Miles Davis, man. I miss his music. I miss his spirit, man. I just wish he was God. I didn't know I was going to miss him like this. And I mean, they say that to me all the time. So it's not just me. It's a lot of people. And I'm saying to you that there, it's not just black African-Americans. It's whites, it's Chinese, it's Japanese, it's Europeans, Africans, Mexicans, everybody in the world. I mean, not just musicians, but artists and writers and bankers and painters and radio people and just women and men, young people and old people. You know, I mean, it's amazing. It's just an amazing kind of thing, you know.
Special thanks to public radio station KPBS at San Diego State University. And thanks also to Quincy Troop, author of the book Miles, the Autobiography and Miles and Me. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.